from the middle of America in the middle of the freaking night. This is TruthNet Radio's TNR Live. And this is Mike Chambers on a Monday night into Tuesday morning. And we've got a great show tonight. And this one is going to knock your socks off. Get ready to have some things that you believe severely tested. This is some really interesting stuff tonight. We're going to talk industrial hemp tonight. And we're going to talk mushrooms. And we're also going to talk some of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And a lot of stuff that we're going to deal with tonight with our guest, Jan Irvin. Jan has a couple of, actually two or three websites. One is hempforfuel.com. That deals with some of the aspects of the industrial uses for hemp as a fuel source and some of the products it can be made into. Also, he has another website with a partner of his, Andy Rutajit, called GnosticMedia.com, which has got a big message board there and a lot of cool stuff that you need to go through and take a look at that. And Jan so graciously joined us tonight. He was going to be with us on Friday night with Richard Andrew Grove. We had some technical problems, but he has such a wide breadth of knowledge. I thought, we need to have him on for a whole show, so here he is. And so far, the middle of the week, it looks like we're fairly open. Friday night, I have confirmed tonight with Barry Zwicker, author of a new book called Towers of Deception. He'll be with us. Barry is traveling all over the place. And we originally had him sit down for Wednesday night. But his schedule has changed. He's doing a number of speaking deals across Canada. And so he'll be with us on Friday night into Saturday morning. And that should be a great show. His new book dealing with the media cover-up of 9/11. And I'm looking forward to talking with him. But the rest of the week is still open at this point, and our invites are still out. So it's funny how all of this just comes together, and these people call it at the strangest times to confirm this stuff. I mean, I just got off the phone with Barry 20 minutes ago. So as he's jaunting from one airport to the next, looking forward to having him on and to talk. And another guest we've got the invites out to. Hopefully hear back from them here in the next day or so. But if not, tomorrow night we'll have an open line show, and we'll go through the news and all that good stuff. Coming up this Saturday night, I'll be down in Dallas, Texas, at the Terrorstorm Dallas event at the Lakewood Theater that's in Dallas at Abrams Park. And this is like the only standalone theater left in Dallas. This was built in the mid-30s. Real art, nice Art Deco stuff, and you can just Google Lakewood Theater Dallas and take a look at the theater and some of the pictures they've got in their gallery. This place is just gorgeous. Reminds me of the theater that I went to as a kid before the multiplexes and all that good stuff. But going to be down there. They're going to be showing Alex Jones' video Terror Storm. Plus, I guess some of his trip to the Bilderberg Ranch up there in Canada. For their big meeting earlier this summer. Also, Jim Mars is going to be there. He's got a new book out. He's going to be talking and doing some speaking, and hopefully we will be able to get him lined up to do the show while we're down there. And so I'm looking forward to that. And I know some people from Oklahoma City who are going down there, and so I'm looking forward to going down and hanging out with them and just spending time getting to know a lot of folks down there. So I'm looking forward to that. I got a report tonight. Actually, a couple reports that the podcasts are not working right, and I think I found the reason why. Seems to be some type of bug in the plugin that I have installed in the website, and I'm working on fixing that. I'll probably do that after the show. For some reason, it's dropping the .mp3 off when it wasn't the other day. And so I'm going to get that fixed and see why it's doing that. I don't understand why, but so maybe I ought to call Ty Rober and have Ty fix it, because Ty's like a webmaster extraordinaire. He knows all that stuff. Maybe I could just call Ty and talk him into it. If I can find Ty. Ty's in the process of moving, I guess. But we'll work on that after the show's over and try to get all that fixed for you. And anytime, you know, if you have a problem with a website or anything, just write us at contact at truthnetradio.com and let us know about it. And that way we can get it fixed up for you. All right. On to our guest, Jan Irvin. Gave you a little intro and bio about him here just a moment ago. Jan, how are you tonight?
Good. How are you doing tonight, Mike?
I'm super, And I have to apologize for the technical problems we had Friday night, because I know that would have been an awesome show with you and Richard Andrew Grove together. But here you are tonight solo, and we're looking forward to a good show.
Well, thank you for having me on. Much appreciated.
Tell us a little bit about yourself, kind of, you know, where you come from and some of the, you know, a little bit of background into some of the work that you've done, and kind of just give us a, you know, a foundation to kind of start the show on.
All right. Well, background, live in Southern California, in the Southern California mountains. Basically, to start off, how I got on this path of research in my late teens, early 20s, my sister and current brother-in-law turned me on to a book called The Emperor Wears No Clothes by Jack Hare, that subtitled Hemp and the Marijuana Conspiracy. And they told me at the time that, and marijuana could be used for making clothes and paper and rope and all of these things. And I told my sister and her husband that they were crazy and didn't really believe what they had to say, you know, in high school and the like. I definitely had my dabble in cannabis and other things and never really had heard anything of the sort. And so it was probably 6 months later, I had traveled up to Northern California to visit my sister at her home, and they pulled out a copy of this book, Jack Hare's book, The Emperor Wears No Clothes, and they showed it to me. And then I sat there and flipped through it and was kind of amazed, and then I drove downtown to the local bookstore and found a copy of it there and bought it and went outside to the parking lot and sat there and read for probably 2 or 3 hours until it was near pitch black outside and I couldn't see another thing anymore. And that really opened my eyes to the suppressed information of industrial hemp and medical marijuana and the current affairs in our political system weren't as we believe them to be.
Right.
And I was probably 18 or 19 at the time, and then by the time I was 22, I had met and become good friends with Jack Hare, and he and I have been close friends for just about 15 years now. And working with him, and I worked with the hemp movement, and I was a coordinator for the California Hemp Initiative and helped with California's Prop 215 for medical marijuana. And the research just sort of continued. The rabbit hole continued to get deeper and go further. And originally, you know, the reason why I started researching heavily into hemp and fact-checking Jack Hare's research was that on the back of his book in the 90s, he had a challenge for $10,000 for anybody to prove his research wrong. And today that challenge stands at $100,000. And you can find the challenge on Jack Hare's website and on the back of his book, etc. And it says, $100,000 challenge to the world to prove us wrong. If all fossil fuels and their derivatives, as well as trees for paper and construction, were banned in order to save the planet, reverse the greenhouse effect, stop deforestation, then there is only one known annual renewable natural resource that is capable of providing the overall majority of the world's paper and textiles, meet all of the world's transportation, industrial, and home energy needs, while simultaneously reducing pollution, rebuilding the soil, and cleaning the atmosphere all at the same time. And that substance is the same one that did it all before, cannabis, hemp, marijuana. And, to say the least, that challenge has been around for close to 20 years now, and Jack Hare has yet to have any takers. So, you know, that's really how I got started, and following Jack's research and the rabbit hole just kept going deeper, and so that's what led me into initially hemp research, and then, as we'll discuss later, into what's known as ethnomycology, which is the study of cultural use of mushrooms, and then archaeoastronomy or astrotheology, which is archaeoastronomy is the study of the use of the stars in the heavens for the measurement of time and the creation of calendars, etc. And astrotheology is basically how the knowledge of the stars and the sun and the moon and the heavens were anthropomorphized into god deities.
And that information really goes way back.
It goes way back. Well, you know, for instance, you know, I suppose we should start with hemp. The record that archaeologists can trace back for the use of hemp industrially for woven fabric and for lamp oil and using the seed for food, etc., dates back to at least 10,000 years. And so, you know, our humankind really has a direct association with the use of cannabis as our primary support for life as far back as we can trace time. And really, it's only been since 1937. And there were some other prohibitions here and there scattered throughout the world, but none like today up until 1937. So, you know, basically, hemp was widespread throughout the world for, you know, for 10,000 years up until this century. So, here we are today.
So, is there any record of how this plant was found? Was it, I mean, I would imagine that it was growing wild and that people over time just found that it had a number of uses and made uses. Is there any record as to how this plant initially was used? I mean, what would have been the first use of it?
Go ahead.
What would have been the first use of it?
The first use of it, I'm guessing, would probably have been nomads or hunter-gatherers basically gathering food supplies and things like that, and especially fuel for the fire. And obviously throwing the cannabis plant on the fire would induce a state of ecstasy that would obviously trigger them to recognize it as the source of something other, you know. And
right.
You know, I it's really hard to say exactly what was used first, but we, like I said, we do have reference to woven fabric dating back 10,000 years from hemp, and you know, cauldrons with seeds and stalks that were burned. What they would do is make these little tents or go into caves and basically throw the cannabis on a central fire and then smoke themselves, you know, fill the room with smoke until they achieved the state that they were looking for. And, you know, the records of the first cannabis paper date back in China, I believe, to 1000 or 1400 B.C., and, you know, it's argued that China and India were far more advanced intellectually than the Europeans because of their much earlier discovery of paper, and most of the original paper was made from hemp, and obviously papyrus, which is where we get the word paper from, but
right.
The primary source for paper was definitely cannabis.
Is there one particular property in this plant that gives it, that allows it to have so many different uses? Is it you know, something in it that in the fibers, or I mean, obviously
well,
the seeds, you know, have an effect, but the fibers, I mean, have so many different uses. Is there one particular property of that plant that makes it special?
Well, yeah, there's a lot of different properties, but you know, one is that other than a couple of strains of bamboo and maybe moss, it's really the fastest out of water growing plant that that we know of. Cannabis can reach 14 to 20 feet or more in under 3 months.
Wow!
But you know, you mentioned the fiber, and the fiber in cannabis is the longest, strongest natural fiber known to man, and so. You know, if we look back through history, the most of the ship sails, I think 90% of the ship sails were made from cannabis, the rest being made from things like flax and sisal and jute, but the majority were made from flax. We have we can look at things like the ancient Gutenberg Bibles that were made from hemp for the paper. But, you know, the core of the woody core of the hemp plant, which is inside the fibers, the fiber is really the bark of the plant. And the woody core is 80% of the plant, and that's 77% cellulose. And cellulose is used for paper and for making plastics, and it was originally used for making dynamite and, you know, just about anything you can imagine. And, in fact, in France, there is an old process which is still used today for making homes. In fact, there's a bridge from 800 current era CE in France that's made of a process called isochanvre, and chanvre means hemp. But basically what they would do is mix hemp herds with limestone and water and create a type of cement that was 10 times lighter but about 10 times stronger, and that's still used in home manufacturing today.
So they would take part of the cellulose portion of the plant and use it in the concrete, or would they just take
the herds are 77% cellulose. Right. They mix that with lime and then mix it with water, and it basically petrifies or forms a cement-like substance that lasts far longer and is far stronger than our current concrete or cement.
You mentioned that cannabis was used to make sails. I wonder if the word canvas is not a derivative of the word cannabis. I mean,
yes. In fact, the word canvas is Dutch for the word cannabis.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, that's exactly where it comes from.
Interesting. Very interesting. And now, you know, we come up to, you had mentioned there had been bans on hemp through time, short-lived ones. What were some of the others before we get into the ban here in the U.S.? What were some of the other bans that had taken place around the world?
Let's see. I believe there was banning of cannabis in ancient Egypt for a time under one of the pharaohs. I don't remember exactly which one. And then cannabis was also banned throughout Europe under the Inquisitions. And it was in large part medicinal banning. You know, anything that was used for medicine other than bleeding or the funny bird's nose that they would fill with herbs and put over somebody's face, and neither of these things worked, but all forms of medicine were outlawed except for those two forms.
And so then that brings us to the 1930s, and at the founding of this country, you know, hemp was widely grown along. I guess hemp and tobacco were probably the two biggest crops here in the United States, you know, at the founding of the country.
Well, I think tobacco came later. Tobacco was adopted from the Native Americans that were here, and cannabis was something that was brought with the sailors, and, you know, the sailing ships at the time, 80% of the ship was actually hemp. You know, the sails of the ship were hemp. The pitch that they used to seal the boards to make the ship float was made from hemp and things like that. So, obviously, you know, the first thing that a colony would need to do to establish security in a new area would be to establish a healthy hemp crop to supply, you know, the needs of the society. But, you know, as you said, you know, the founding fathers, you know, used hemp. It was actually required by law to grow hemp in the original 13 colonies. I think it was Jamestown in the 1600s passed a law requiring all farmers to grow hemp. Thomas Jefferson said that hemp was necessary for the defense of the nation. I believe it was him that said that. He definitely had numerous quotes about hemp. Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, and Ben Franklin were all hemp farmers. And in fact, Ben Franklin opened our country's first paper mill and our first printing press with the use of hemp paper. Mm-hmm. And back then, what they would do is use the old sails and ropes from the ships to make what was called rag paper, and rag paper was used for the drafting of the Declaration of Independence and the U.S. Constitution. The U.S. Constitution later ended up on lambskin for the final copy, but it was definitely drafted on hemp. And hemp was legal tender to pay your taxes with, I believe, until 1865 in this country. But it was commonly used for trade and many other things as well.
Well, the one question that has to be asked, and I'm sure anybody listening at this point is thinking, wait a minute, were our founding fathers smoking dope? I mean, just I don't know any better way to ask it. But were they smoking marijuana?
Well, marijuana use at that time was a lot less common. There is record in George Washington's diary that he would grow Indian hemp, and he and I believe it was either Thomas Jefferson or Ben Franklin would actually have competitions between each other to see who could grow the best, what we call today marijuana. But what you have to realize is that at that time, you know, marijuana or cannabis hemp was not stigmatized at all. It had been used in medicines and food and fuel and everything for thousands of years, and it was just, it was considered a common staple, you know, and in fact, hemp seed is actually one of the most nutritious food sources known to humankind. It's 65% protein, and it's got the highest level of essential fatty acids, gamma linolenic and gamma linoleic essential fatty acids of just about any other food source. I think the avocado may come close to hemp seed in its nutritional value, but the hemp seed oil was used for all of these various things. So, you know, if we take into account how widespread it was for medicinal use, and I think marijuana up until 1890 was one of the top three prescribed medications next to morphine or opium and alcohol. And then I think in 1890 was when aspirin was invented and began to edge marijuana out, but it was still recommended for about 100 different ailments known at the time, everything from gout to menstrual cramps and migraines and asthma and all kinds of things. So put it in that context, it doesn't, you know, it's not so astounding to know that our founding fathers used cannabis.
And then I would imagine late in the 19th century, a person wanting this would just go into a pharmacy and ask for some. The pharmacist would basically grind it up right there for them and put it in a little box or a package, and off they went.
Well, up until that point, it was more common that extracts were used of cannabis. And it was far more common that the Indian hemp or cannabis indica, as opposed to cannabis sativa, was used for that. And cannabis indica, obviously, is from India, and it's a slightly stronger strain. Looking at the preparational usage, it was primarily prescribed in other medications. I think 20% of all medications at the time, up until about either 1910 or 1920, were made from cannabis. And even today, there are doctors and professors who argue that cannabis could replace anywhere from 10 to 40% of all medicines in use today.
And from what I understand, the cannabis doesn't have the type of side effects that a number of the other drugs that we use today have.
Right. You know, I don't remember the name off the top of my head. Let me see here. Now, there's a drug that's used for asthmatics that is known to have phenylamine or something like that, that is known to have very serious side effects in some people. And cannabis has been proven effective for asthmatics in 80% of users. And cannabis has been proven effective in the treatment of glaucoma far better than most other medications. It's been used as they've created antibiotics and analgesics from it, and all sorts of things from the plant. But what happened was in 1917, hemp was really on the way out from 1865 on because of the invention of the cotton gin. And prior to 18, 65, unfortunately, the use of cannabis or the production of cannabis was done with slave labor.
Right.
And what we're not told in our history books is that the majority of the plantations in the South were actually hemp plantations, not cotton plantations. Cotton plantations made up, a fraction, over 8,000 of the major plantations in the South were hemp plantations. And with the end of slavery, hemp was on a major decline. Mm-hmm. And then in 1917, a guy, George, I believe his last name was Slichen, or something similar, invented and patented a machine called the decorticating machine that basically took the labor to produce an acre of raw hemp material, which with man labor took about 200 to 300 hours an acre and turned it down to 2 or 3 hours for an acre. And it was poised to revolutionize the newspaper industry and various other industries. And William Randolph Hearst, Hearst Newspaper Company, his largest competitor, was the one who had put a lot of the money into the production of this decorticating machine. And with before the decorticating machine was completed, the threat of paper pulp prices, there was a threat that the prices were going to double. So I don't remember the man who funded Mr. Slichen's research on the decorticator, but he basically got frightened and pulled out of the research. And then the decorticator didn't reappear again until 1936. And when Popular Mechanics and another magazine ran an article basically stating that marijuana was the new billion-dollar crop, and that this decorticating machine was going to revolutionize everything from paper to textiles to, you know, thousands of other uses. And today we now know that industrial hemp can be used for over 50,000 different products, right, ranging from fine laces and lingerie to heavy jeans. In fact, original Levi's were made from industrial hemp, to books and Bibles and soaps and foods and, you know, it's the list of products that can be made from it is just amazing. In fact, you know, like I mentioned earlier, the production of the you know, Isochambre, the hemp homes in France, you could actually, except for, you know, steel and glass windows, an entire home could be made from industrial hemp. And in fact, Bill Condi, who owns a lumber company up in Oregon, back in the 90s working with Washington State University, proved that they could make building material and beams and boards and everything with hemp herds and hemp natural glues that are in the plant that was far stronger than timber for building material.
Wow.
And then even the pipes, like the PVC piping and things like that, have been shown to be easily made from cellulose plastics. You know, you can think of your computer that you're on right now. All the plastic parts for the computer could be made with hemp, and so the list of things that it can be used for, you know, goes on. But with the announcement in Popular Mechanics, and I was the other major publication, Popular Engineering or something like that, that ran the other article, that basically gave an alarm to the powers that be, primarily DuPont Company, Andrew Mellon, Randolph Hearst, who was a part of the Narcotics Bureau, he's the head of the Narcotics Bureau. And with alcohol prohibition ending, Anslinger was looking for a new place to save his task force, and so they targeted the outline of marijuana to promote the chemical productions from the DuPont Company. And William Randolph Hearst's uncle was Andrew Mellon, who was on the board of trustees of DuPont and was also a famous international and very corrupt banker. And so they conspired to outlaw hemp and pass the Marijuana Tax Act in 1937. And what they did was they literally created the name marijuana. It was a colloquial name from for a slang term for most scholars believe it was hemp, but it could have even been another plant. And really just blindsided the farmers with this law. They basically snuck it through and didn't tell anybody that hemp and cannabis or marijuana were the same thing. Mm-hmm. And what Harry Anslinger did to pass the anti, quote-unquote, marijuana laws was he would go around the country and into the courts and everything and present this book that he carried with him called the Gore Files. And basically what the Gore Files were sensationalized stories from the Hearst newspapers, going back to Hearst and the Decorticator, of the supposed negative effects of marijuana. And basically people would go around and murder and steal and rob and go completely bananas from smoking one puff of marijuana. And then what was interesting is by World War II, Henry Anslinger did a complete backflip and said that marijuana didn't cause violence, that it caused such pacifism that it had to be outlawed because the Russian and Chinese military would be able to overtake the U.S. if all of our people were pacifistic.
Hold that thought right there. We're talking with Jan Ervin of HempForFuel.com and GnosticMedia.com. We're in the middle of discussing industrial hemp, and it's about to get interesting with the onset of World War II. Marijuana's been banned. It's evil. It's bad. Can't have it around. Tide turns just a little bit. More on that coming up here in just a couple of minutes on TruthNet Radio and TNR Live. turn it loose. Let everybody know that TNR Live is on.
That's right. Just pick up the phone and call them.
Hey, look, I know it's 12:40 at night, but that's a pretty dead good talk show on. Get up, get up.
That's what you need to do. Yeah, TruthNet Radio and Mike Chambers on a Monday night into Tuesday morning. It's TNR Live. And our guest tonight is Jan Irvin. We're talking right now about industrial hemp. And it's a crop that's been around since time immemorial. Man has used it in a number of ways, and we brought it kind of up to World War II. It was demonized, and we had to get totally rid of it. But Jan, World War II kind of changed the status of hemp somewhat, did it not?
Yes, it did. Well, in World War II, the Japanese had cut off our Manila hemp supplies, and so the United States was desperately seeking a way to fill the demand for fiber in this country, and not being able to import it, the United States government asked the farmers through the 4-H clubs to begin growing industrial hemp. So from, I believe, 1942 to 1946, I think 40 or 50,000 acres of hemp were planted a year to help the war efforts, because, like I said earlier, with the old ships, the sails were made from that, but even with the modern warships, the anchor lines were still made from cannabis. And what a lot of people don't know is that things like parachutes and uniforms and things like that were often still made from hemp. And in fact, it's very well documented that during World War II, when George Bush Sr. was shot down in his plane on the Pacific Theater, his parachute, the webbing, and everything was actually made from hemp. So it's kind of ironic that one of the leaders in eradicating this most useful plant literally had his life saved by the very plant he's trying to eradicate.
Isn't that irony? And but another irony is, in fact, here it is, it's a banned substance in the United States, and we're buying it from overseas, and still it's cut off. I mean, that's ironic in itself.
Right. Well, in Canada, in the late 90s, began producing hemp again. In the last 10 years, or 15 years, really, since Jack Harris' book really began gaining some steam, the use of industrial hemp has been brought back to about 50 different countries. And, I used to live in Yugoslavia, and they still had a flourishing, and I wouldn't say flourishing, it was probably running at 5 to 10% of what it used to before the sanctions, but still had a hemp industry there. And I was in Hungary, and they still had a hemp industry making very fine linens. In fact, I was in downtown Budapest one day, and I look in a store, and they had a 100% hemp wedding gown advertised in one of the nice bridal stores there. It's still produced in China. In fact, in the late 90s, the United States down in Brawley, California, actually allowed a test crop, and then a week or 2 weeks before the crop was to be harvested, the DEA went in and cut the entire crop down. But, France still grows a lot of hemp. Italy does. France grows industrial hemp for making paper. In fact, most cigarette paper, most people don't know, is actually hemp. Italy has a record of making some of the finest writing paper and linens and things like that, fine lace and things from hemp. And, so its use in various parts of the world is still very widespread. And I think in 1546, the Spanish king ordered that all of the new colonies in South America were required to grow hemp, and that stood until the U.S. government went in and began forcing the various countries around the world to outlaw hemp.
So why is the demonization of this plant been allowed to continue for so long? I mean, we're 60 years removed from its initial ban by the federal government.
70 years,
and so there are so many uses for this product that we could virtually cut our dependence on oil overnight. you know, it's an easily renewable resource. I mean, this ethanol thing is a load of malarkey. They ran it on us in the 70s that ethanol was going to, you know, help cut our dependency on oil. It takes so much corn just to make a gallon of the stuff, it's not going to be cost effective.
Yeah, you know, and in fact, Cornell University did a study last summer stating that ethanol production for fuel supply was impossible. But what I found interesting about the Cornell study is they ignored another study that they did on hemp 10 or 15 years prior to that, stating how valuable industrial hemp was for a fuel source.
Mm-hmm. What about pollutants from burning hemp? Are they the same as with burning wood or with oil, or are they less?
Well, it's about the same as burning oil, but with burning hemp, we're not releasing sulfur into the air.
Right.
And carbon dioxide, one of the two, carbon monoxide or carbon dioxide, is absent in the burning of biomass fuels. Mm-hmm. As opposed to petroleum fossil fuels. And the main difference with the pollution with hemp and fossil fuels is that hemp requires most of the pollutants back as it grows. And not only that, if we, you know, began using hemp for paper, you know, 1 acre of hemp produces as much paper as 4.1 acres of trees over the same amount of time. But if those trees were actually left standing and oxygenating the planet, obviously the trees would be eliminating a lot of that pollution along with the industrial hemp. And it's estimated that, you know, while Cornell University and these other studies say that methanol and ethanol production could not be achieved with corn and things like that, what we do know, which Jack Hare and Lynn and Judy Osborne proved in the 90s, was that using 6% of arable land in the United States would supply enough hemp to satisfy all of our countries, or 90% of our country's energy needs.
Well, and the other thing about, you know, that this ethanol stuff is, a lot of people don't realize, is that it's going to diminish the life of an engine anyway, because those type of alcohol fuels dry an engine out, so the lubrication that you have, that lubricate your valves, your pistons, and everything begin to dry out. And I had had an old car I used to drive that had water in the tank all the time. So I used to put a little methanol in it every now and then to kind of dry that up. Well, that worked great for about 6 months until the use of the methanol in the car burned the oil pump up. And that's another thing I don't think people realize is that, you know, if we introduce this type of a fuel into the population, you're looking at your automobile repair costs going way up.
Well, you know, to interrupt your point there, if you study the history of hemp oil as a lubricant, you'll find that the U.S. military actually ranks hemp oil as one of the highest quality engine lubricants available.
Wow. That's,
you know, so, you know, and in fact, I don't know how much lubrication oil is used today for engines and stuff like that by the U.S. military, but I know, you know, through the 40s and at least up into the 50s and probably the 60s as well, hemp was used as the primary lubricating oil for engines and things like that with the military. So, you know, it's like, while there might be drawbacks of using ethanol or methanol for fuel, at the same time, it seems that the hemp plant tends to have the natural answer to solve the problem.
So what's the disconnect? Is the disconnect that it everybody's going to get high if we're driving around on it, or...
Well, you know, that's what they would like us to think, you know, and what's interesting is that the California Highway Patrol, I don't remember the year, there's a study that they did testing marijuana users and drivers not under the influence of anything, and the study was fairly close. You know, there were some lacks in response times, but that also depends highly upon the experience, the amount of experience the person has with using cannabis, and whether or not it's somebody that's never used it before, they're going to have much more trouble with it. But, you know, if you look at the number, I think 75 or 80% of all fatal car accidents are with alcohol. something that we already already use, and which is a problem. But, you know, the cannabis THC does not affect the balance centers of the brain, and it, and does not cause the type of inebriation that would cause you know, reckless driving and things like that. And in fact, you know, the it used to be that one of the what do they call it? One of the profiles for finding a driver under the influence of cannabis was that they were a perfect driver. So try that on for a stigma. You know?
Well, that's like in this day and age, being a terrorist, you're wearing blue jeans and you're nice to the cops. So
right.
Yeah, I can fully see where they would use it as a profile. So where does the fight to allow industrial hemp to be used again here in the United States, at least 3,000 products that I've heard that it can be used in?
Well, like I said earlier, it's well documented, at least 50,000 products. 3,000 products is what was documented in the 1910s and 20s, but it's gone far beyond that today.
So where do we go? I mean, how do we start changing the minds of the people, you know, in power? That this is a type of resource, one that's easily renewable. I mean, it grows wild, for God's sakes. And
Go ahead.
You're fine.
Well, you know, what I was going to say is I don't think that approaching the people in power is what's going to solve the problem, because the people in power are the ones that have outlawed it. But, you know, the one thing that the U.S. government is, and any fascist government is afraid of, is education. And, you know, while Jack Kerr put this information out 20 years ago, and, you know, to me it just seems like common knowledge, because I've been around this information so long, and there's been so many hemp rallies and major hemp events throughout the country and throughout the world, even annually. There's a million marijuana march every year on Washington, is either Washington or New York. But, you know, there has been progress in various states to allow hemp farming, and like I said, you know, California had a hemp crop, 10 years ago that was cut down just before it was ready to go to the factory. But there are campaigns all over the country, and they're always ongoing. But, you know, with the controlling media, there really hasn't been much talk about industrial hemp. In the late 90s, or actually mid 90s, we did get some television programs that would come on and give brief little talks about it and things like that, but you know, pretty soon it was brushed back under the rug. And you know, it seems since about 2000, the information on industrial hemp is for the most part escaped the public mind. And you know, I attribute part of that to my friend Jack Herr. He had a major stroke in 2000 and wasn't really able to lead the hemp movement single-handedly, as he had done for over 20 years, any longer. But the hemp movement is still there, and it's still going, and we do have, you know, successes here and there. I think it was last year, the city of Oakland passed a law making marijuana the lowest possible offense below jaywalking and spitting on the sidewalk.
Right.
You know, and Seattle, Washington has done the same thing. And Seattle, Washington, for the last 10 years, has hosted the huge Seattle Hemp Fest, which annually brings in about 200,000 visitors and packs the hotels and really has a huge following. But you're not going to find the information about industrial hemp in the corporate media very often.
Well, it all goes back to something that Richard Andrew Grove has mentioned on numerous occasions, the fact that we don't know our history. You know, if it was something we knew our history, then we would have known that the great uses for this product, and the ban probably would have never been allowed to have been put into place in the first time at all.
Right, you know, and, you know, as like Hitler said, the bigger the lie, the more people will believe it. And unfortunately, people in our culture don't have the common sense to fact-check things that they're told by the media. You know, when I hear something on the news, especially the corporate news, the first thing I do is I go out and I fact-check it.
Right.
And, you know, 90% of the time it ends up being complete garbage. But your average citizen watches Fox or CNN or MSNBC and these stations, and you know, gets fed their daily fill of propaganda and, you know, believes it unquestioningly like some religious faith. And, you know, it's rather unfortunate because that type of ignorance has really led our society down the wrong path.
Well, and I mean, it's interesting because people will parrot exactly what was said on a television show the night before. I've seen discussions about things, here in the United States about things changing. It always goes left-right. And that's all part and parcel of what we have been told by the media, that right is good, left is bad, or vice versa, depending on your point of view.
Except you forget there is a whole body walking the left and right legs along.
Exactly. And that, usually there's not much difference between the left and the right leg, if any at all.
Right.
But, this whole story of industrial hemp just brings it home widescreen that we have to start looking at our past to understand what's happening to us now. Because, again, history repeats itself. And the reason history repeats itself is because it worked before, it'll work again. And so the powers that be that will continue to run the same playbook over and over and over because, again, you know, it works. I used a football analogy here the other night. If I know that I'm going to make 6 yards a carry by running the football off the left tackle, I'm going to run the football off the left tackle every time. Because every two downs, I'm going to make a first down. And I'm going to continue to run that play until you on the defense can stop me. And then I'll come up with another play. And that's what we see here. Look at the demonization of this product. This is a product that was used medicinally. It was used industrially. And then overnight, practically, it was turned into basically a pariah.
Yeah, the demon weed, the devil weed.
Well, I mean, even in the movies.
You know, one thing I forgot to mention earlier is how they pushed the marijuana laws through. I think it was originally California and Utah that were the first to ban marijuana before it was banned at the federal level and with the Tax Act in 1937. But how they banned it was basically banned against blacks and Mexicans. Mm-hmm. And what they said was that marijuana enabled black musicians to play music that would entice white women to touch them and want to sleep with them. And, the same thing with Mexicans. It made Mexican men want to step on white men's shadows and to look at white women, which was illegal at the time. So, you know, the whole outline of marijuana was based on complete prejudice and no science whatsoever. As it's still not, you know, the federal government has spent 70 years looking for scientific evidence to substantiate their claims, and you know, in the 20s, marijuana led to heroin led to marijuana, and the 30s and 40s it was reversed, I remember in the 80s it was said that marijuana caused sterility and would cause men to grow breasts, and in the 90s it was back again to the gateway drug theory leading on to other things. And you know, it's been scientifically proven that one substance cannot give you an addiction for another substance.
Right.
You know, so the whole gateway theory is kind of a farce. And if we want to look at gateway theories, you know, it's like how many kids are given medicines with alcohol in them, or given a taste of wine or beer or hard alcohol as a child, you know. And alcohol is responsible for the majority of murders and violence and rapes and things like that, where, you know, crimes related directly to marijuana are almost non-existent.
But it was a convenient
boogeyman. Other than the illegal trade and use of them.
Right, but it was a convenient boogeyman. I mean, there's always... It was a convenient boogeyman. I mean, the alcohol at the end of Prohibition, they realized they were not going to stop its use or its sale. And so they had no choice but to end Prohibition. And, of course, as you mentioned, they needed another boogeyman, and hemp was the next choice.
Yeah. Anslinger was going to lose, I think, 200,000, which, you know, in 1920 time, that was a huge amount of money, but he was basically, he stood to lose his entire narcotics task force, which is now today called the DEA, but you know, he really stood a lot to lose, as did the DuPont Company and Andrew Mellon, so they conspired, and 70 years later, the entire world has paid the cost for these men's greed and public deception.
And now we have a war on drugs that never ends, because we've got both sides playing against the middle. You've got the CIA funding the whole operation and helping to bring it in, while you've got the DEA on the other side doing the enforcement and everything. And then in the middle, we have this wonderful plant that could be used for so many things that basically could change the way we live, you know, quite quickly, and the entire climate politically around the world.
Definitely. You know, I wanted to use your statement a few minutes ago about, you know, people not studying and understanding their history. I'd like to use that statement as a springboard to kind of change things over to another topic here at the top of the hour.
Indeed, yes.
If you don't mind.
No, not at all. That's one of the reasons why I mentioned it, because I thought it would be a nice little segue into next hour. Which we've got about 2 minutes until the top. Kind of give us a preview a little bit, Jan, here, of what we're going to talk about next hour. Because I think it's for some of the folks who are listening, this is going to be mind-blowing, and it's going to really make them question some of the things that they've heard and that they've learned throughout their life.
Well, what we'll be discussing is the history of what, you know, a couple of things I mentioned earlier, which was astrotheology and archaeoastronomy and their basis and the origins of all of the world's major religions, along with entheogenic, or more commonly called psychedelic shamanism, which is the use of plants and drugs for religious purposes throughout history.
Right. So that's what we're looking forward to next hour. And so you need to put your thinking cap on. You need to listen. Jan, why don't you tell us about your websites and what they can find there, and that way maybe during the break some people can go in and check those out and you know, kind of get just a little bit ahead of us here in the game for next hour.
Sure. Well, the primary website with my co-author and I is Gnostic Media, and I guess I should spell that because most people don't know how to spell Gnostic. That's Gnostic Media.com, and that's our publishing website. And then we have another website that's a part of the Gnostic Media site that's called the Pharmacratic Inquisition. And that site is actually for a video that we produced back in 2004 detailing the history of archaeoastronomy and shamanism in religion, especially in Christianity. And pharmacratic is spelled like pharmacy. It's pharmacratic, and then inquisition.com. And then I run, like you said earlier, hemperfuel.com, and then I also run thehemper.net. And thehemper.net has a little bit of a story behind it, and that's actually how Andrew and I met. Is he was doing research on 911, and on the hemper.net website, I house the She Remembers audio archives, which is a large collection of underground news material that a friend of mine collected for 12 years up until her death in April 2002, when she handed all of the archives over to me, and then I produced and released them on MP3, CD, and DVD archives.
All right. Okay, well, we're going to come back and going to take a quick break. And we've got Jan Irvin with us, and it's about to get really good. So don't go anywhere. There's more to come here on TruthNet Radio and TNR Live.
somehow. Love can't be explained.
TruthNetRadio.com's TNR Live. Monday night into Tuesday morning. My name is Mike Chambers. How are you doing tonight? Hope you're enjoying this show. It's been good. First hour, industrial hemp. This hour, suppression. Is what you've been taught really the truth? Well, remains to be seen. This hour is going to tell the tale. Our guest is Jan Irvin tonight. He is the operator of a website called hempforfuel.com and Gnostic Media, G-N-O-S-T-I-C, media.com. And he is our guest tonight. And we're discussing suppression, and we'll be with Jan here in just a couple of moments. Friday night on the show, we're going to have Barry Zwicker. That confirmed earlier tonight. Barry, the author of a new book called Towers of Deception. And I think he also did, I think the name of it was called The Great Deception, or The Great Conspiracy, that the 9/11 news show you never saw, that's available on video now. I think you can even get it on Google Video. And Barry's a former media critic and from Canada, and so he has some unique insights into media. And his book, latest book, discusses the media cover-up regarding 9/11. Which should prove to be an interesting show. That's this Friday night from midnight to 2, right here Central Time on TruthNetRadio.com. So let everybody know that Barry's going to be on.
and bury a major speaker around the country and in Canada. And matter of fact, one of the things he's doing this week is he's going to, is doing a ton of speaking, and will be speaking with us after one of his engagements, I believe, in Calgary this week. So it's our honor to have him on later this week. Rest of the week is still kind of open. It looks like we've got two or three open line shows for right now. We're still in the process of trying to fill the rest of the week up. And then on Saturday down to Dallas for Terror Storm. I may try to take a laptop or something with me to try to maybe record some stuff down there. I haven't decided yet. I may do that, though. Been thinking about it. We'll see. And see. You know, if nothing else, we'll have some pictures of everything that went on that we'll put up on the website for you, which I think will be cool, and kind of see what goes on down there. And I'm looking forward to seeing you if by chance it, you're going to make your way down to Big D for the event there at the Lakewood Theater. And again, that's Saturday. I think it starts at 7 Central. And I know some people from Oklahoma City are going, and a lot of people from the Austin area and Dallas will be there. So really, if you're in Oklahoma or Texas or even Louisiana or Arkansas, you know, it's not too far to go for you to, you know, to come and see that. And if you're there, hope you come by and say hi. I'm the big ugly guy. Just look for me. I'm easy to see. All right, back to our guest, Jan Irvin here. And Jan, we're going to hit on some subject that, like I mentioned last hour, is going to probably challenge some things that people have been taught. And just everybody listening with an open mind this hour. And this kind of, how did all this research kind of come about? How did it begin? And you mentioned earlier for you, you know, it started with industrial hemp, and then you kind of led it other areas. But this research in particular that we're going to look at this hour, kind of how did it start? Not for you, but basically as a science itself.
Okay. Well, as a science, what is known that, well, there's actually two parts of the science here. I guess I should mention them both. As I said earlier, the archaeoastronomy, and then the other is ethnomycology or entheomycology. And so I guess I should define what both of those are. I already did the astrotheology and archaeoastronomy definition previously. What mycology is it's the study of mushrooms, and what and theomycology is the study of mushrooms for religious purposes. And the overall foundation or beginnings of entheomycology began with R. Gordon Wasson, who was an amateur mycologist, and basically in the late 1920s, I believe it was, he and his wife, new bride-to-be, went on a walk in the forest, and his Gordon Wasson's wife, her name was Valentina Pavlovna, I believe, and she was a Russian woman. And when on their honeymoon, they decided to take a walk to the forest in upstate New York. And Valentina spotted mushrooms and ran off into the forest to pick them. And she collected them up and put them in her dress, and Wasson was in shock and awe over the whole thing, and Wasson being Anglo-Saxon and Valentina being Russian, the two had very serious juxtaposed beliefs on mushrooms and their history. And you know, Valentina went home that night to cook up the mushrooms, and Wasson was in a state of panic, thinking that he was going to wake up the next morning as a widower. And so that sparked research between the two to find out why different societies were mycophobes and others were mycophiles, those who feared mushrooms and then those who love mushrooms. Russia is a very mycophile society, and England and most of the rest of Western Europe is very mycophobic, you know, just being afraid of mushrooms and not having a very deep understanding of them, and allowing prejudice and a myth instead of fact to take control of their emotions over the mushrooms. So that sent Wasson and his wife on many years of research, and basically from there, Wasson and his wife had simultaneously discovered associations to the use of mushrooms in religion, and both of them had sort of kept their discoveries from each other. And then they begin to compare notes that they had found, thinking that they weren't, you know, thinking that the idea was so ridiculous that they decided to hold it back from each other until one day they sat down deciding whether or not they should continue on with their research or scrap it altogether. And then when they both compared notes and realized that they had came to the same conclusions, that drugs were the basis of many of the world's religions, then that sent them on a major path on what is today known as I said earlier, entheomycology. So Gordon Wasson was the founding father, typically, but there was another researcher at the British Museum in London that his name was Ramsbottom, Professor Ramsbottom. And he had come to some of the same conclusions in his book and made some suggestions before Wasson. And then there was another researcher before them, another amateur mycologist, I believe also from England, named Rolf. Actually, I think it was he and his wife as well, Rolf and Rolf. And then they came out with a book called The Romance of the Fungus World, which had discovered in France a fresco, the Plancarolle fresco, that depicted Amanita or Adam and Eve on either side of an Amanita muscaria mushroom. Mm-hmm. And this fresco dates back to, I believe, the 12th century, could be the 13th century. But, you know, so that sort of sparked Wasson, that sort of sparked the investigation in one aspect into the history of religions that was by Ramsbottom and Rolf specifically. And then Wasson and his wife had discovered that Soma and the Rig Vedas, the most likely candidate for Soma was the Amanita muscaria mushroom, in their opinion. So in, I think it was 1968, Gordon Wasson and his wife published Soma, the divine mushroom of immortality, which was largely accepted in academic circles and still is for being the foundation of the Hindu religion. And, you know, not only mushrooms were used in the Hindu religion, but they're, you know, going back to last hour, the sacred drink bhang or bhang that's used in the Hindu religion is made from cannabis. And in fact, Bangladesh literally means marijuana land people, or cannabis land people. Bang is their word for marijuana. Right. So that's the foundation of the entheogenic or shamanic side of the studies that I do. And then on the other side, there is archaeoastronomy and astrotheology. And I'm not 100% sure on who were the first to really go public with that. There's sort of been light trailings of research in that area all throughout history. Kersey Graves and Gerald Macy in at the turn of last century, or actually at the turn of the 1900s, published works that suggested that Jesus and a lot of the mythological characters were based on sun worship. And today there are quite a number of authors. Actually, in the 1940s, Ernest Busenbarg published a book called Symbol, Sex, and the Stars. There's a very well-known researcher named Jordan Maxwell, and in fact, that would probably be a very good lead for you to have as a guest on your show. He's spent about 45 years researching astrotheology, and he wrote the foreword for our book, Astrotheology and Shamanism. And, you know, so he's got a very well-rounded background in that area, but he doesn't go into great detail on the entheogens. You know, that's more of our specialty, but he definitely does mention them. But Ataria S. and, you know, in 1929, Manly P. Hall, the founder of the Philosophical Research Society in L.A., wrote a book called The Secret Teachings of All Ages, which also covered the same history of the worship of the cosmos as divine deities. And really that's where I want to start delving into the subject of... It's easier to go into astrotheology and archaeoastronomy first and then sort of branch over into the shamanic side.
Right.
But basically, when we study our history, going back to reading and studying again, we find that the majority of the ancient so-called pagan religions were based on sun worship and drug use. And I'll explain this more as we go through here, but with the history of sun worship and religion, if we look at a lot of the ancient cultures like Horus of Egypt and Mithra of Persia and Dionysus of the Greeks and Attis and Tammuz and Adonai and all of these various gods, these are actually astrological and solar myths. They're based, they're literally anthropomorphisms of the sun and the stars and the moon. And when we look at this, we find, like, for instance, Mithra was born of a virgin on December 25th. Horus is said to have been born of a virgin on December 25th. Dionysus, there's many gods. They were born on either December 25th or the summer solstice or maybe the spring equinox. And these were the common days. Today we celebrate the equinox, which is called Easter in the Christian religion, as the returning of Christ from the tomb for 3 days. But when we look at these stories, what exactly does it mean? What does it mean to have Jesus return from the tomb for 3 days? What does it mean to have these gods all being born on December 25th of a virgin? And so, you know, we'll kind of start from there.
Okay. So, so we talk about December 25th. You say it deals with the equinox, but what's the importance of those dates? I mean... What do they represent?
Well, the December 25th is actually the solstice, not the equinox.
Well, it's got a solstice, but what is it represented as far as symbology is concerned in these religions?
Well, the December 25th is actually the first day of winter, and you know you can kind of count it on the winter solstice, which is December 21st. But if we look at the night sky from the summer solstice, which is typically around June 21st until the winter solstice on December 25th, what occurs is the sun is literally falling towards the south a little bit closer each day. You know, if we think back a month and a half ago on June 21st, the sun went down at 9 o'clock, you know, it was extremely hot. And, you know, so this was the time that the sun was brightest in the sky and the days were the longest.
Right.
And each day from the summer solstice, and it depends on which hemisphere you're in, which way the sun is going, but from the summer solstice, the sun begins falling slightly towards the south each day. And that's where we get the term fall from. The sun is falling, so we have fall or the autumn. And what happens is when the sun reaches December 21st, the sun stops falling to the south, but it doesn't bounce back immediately to the north. What happens is the sun hovers or sort of stands still. The sun is in a tomb for 3 days, from December 21st until the morning of December 25th. And then what happens is on December 25th, the sun begins slowly heading back towards the north, and then the cycle repeats itself again once it reaches the summer solstice. So with... Do you have something to say?
Well, I was going to say, so basically it equates to birth and resurrection then after the 3 days. Of course, Jesus rose from the grave, and so it would seem to indicate that it's birth and resurrection both together, I would imagine.
Yes. birth, resurrection, well, the virgin birth, and I'll go into that more here as well, but birth and resurrection with Easter, and we'll cover Easter here as we sort of span astrotheology here. But with December 25th, the night before December 25th, something in the sky very amazing happens, and it actually happens every year. So all of these people that are waiting for the return of Jesus Christ don't actually realize that the sun actually returns every single year on December 25th when it begins its trek back north. But on December 24th at dusk, what we see is the alignment of the three stars of the belt of Orion pointing, to the exact spot where the sun will be born on the morning of December 25th. So literally the three magi, or the three wise men, as most of the stories tell us. The Bible just says magi were the magicians and the shaman as well, but that's a whole other story. The three magi were following the bright star, the bright star of Bethlehem. And the bright star of Bethlehem is what we today call Sirius, or the two-dog star, Cephus. And that's the star of Bethlehem. So you have the three stars of the belt of Orion preceding, as the Christmas song goes, westward leading, still preceding. The three stars of the belt of Orion are preceding the rise of Sirius, the star of Bethlehem. And then if we follow a straight line down from the three stars of the belt of Orion and Sirius, it will point down to the location on the horizon that the sun will rise the next morning. And so literally this alignment of the stars is pointing to where the sun god, or the god sun in the sky, is born the next morning. But before that happens, at midnight, and this is something that all of us can go out on Christmas Eve and watch, at around midnight to maybe 2 o'clock in the morning, what happens is, in this alignment, the head of Virgo, the celestial virgin, sticks her head up over the horizon. And as we roll through the night, the virgin continues to rise up over the horizon, and then just... oh, an hour, I think it's about 2 hours before sunrise, she literally steps on the head of the serpent with her left foot, and we always see the Christian paintings depicting Mary stepping on the head of the serpent. The serpent is actually the constellation of serpents in the night sky. And then after she steps on the head of the serpent, we have daybreak, and then the sun drops between Virgo's legs. So we have the story of the Immaculate Conception of Jesus being born on December 25th of a virgin, and this is all astrotheological. This was knowledge that the ancients used to basically tell time, to know what time of year it was, to know when to plant, when to harvest, when to store their food. And if they didn't have this basic knowledge of the cosmos, they perished. So this was very important information. People didn't have a calendar on the wall or on their computer desktop that they looked at and went to tell them when they needed to do things. They had to follow the night sky. So that is the tale of Christianity, the origins of Jesus, of Krishna, of Horus, of Mithra, of Dionysus, and Dionysus, and these other gods.
Now, watching your video earlier, I remember you and Andy mentioned that there were 16 different accounts of a Savior crucified on a cross, but virgin birth, all this, but 16 different accounts throughout history of basically the same story.
Right. Well, there's actually more than that. What we show is in reference to Kersey Graves' book, The World's 16 Crucified Saviors. And actually, that was written in 1889 or 1890 or somewhere thereabouts. But today, Acharya S. published a book a couple of years back. I don't remember if it was The Christ Conspiracy or Sons, S-U-N, Sons of God. But she found, I think, 31 or 32 different stories. Quetzalcoatl is another one that was you know, born of a virgin and died for our sins, you know, and so was Mithra. He was born of a virgin, died for our sins. He was called the Way, the Truth, the Light, the God's anointed son, and all of these characters basically had the same story. You know, they died for our sins and they were resurrected. You know, the son, it gives its life for us, it dies, and then it's resurrected. When the sun is born in the wintertime, it's low on the horizon and it's small because, you know, the earth is, from our perspective, is furthest from the sun when the northern hemisphere tips away from the sun. So the sun is smaller on the horizon. And, you know, as we go to spring, we come to the spring equinox and the celebration of Easter. And the sun, you know, the celebration of Easter was originally a pagan, and I really dislike the word pagan. It just comes from the Latin word paganus, which means rural or the country people. But the pagans celebrated their fertility cults and the planting of the crops at the spring equinox. So if we look at that, and then a lot of people may question, well, you know, how does that relate to Easter? Well, you know, if you don't believe that Easter is based on astrotheology, just look at how we determine when Easter is. We wait for the spring equinox, and then we wait for the first full moon, and then we celebrate Easter, Easter, on the following sun day. You know, so literally, and Christianity adopted Sunday as the day of worship because it's a sun worship religion.
Right.
You know, the Jews and the Hebrews worship Saturn, and it was based, you know, Saturn Saturday. So this is where these dates come from and why they're important. And then, of course, Pentecost falls on the night of the 50th day after Easter. So, you know, we have all of these different celebrations that are in complete astrological alignments with the spring equinox and winter solstice celebrations.
In the research that you've done, does this story originate with one culture, or is this a case where each culture has basically come up with their own set of myths, or is there an origination for the myth itself?
Well, that's a very good question, you know, and it's, you know, that's something that when you begin to study your religious history, and you look at all of these different religions, either you have one of two options. Either one, the basic knowledge was ubiquitous that was formed on, or two, it was spread, globally. And, you know, some have argued that some of the knowledge spread from Siberia and downward, and obviously trans-Pacifically across the Bering Strait. But, you know, what we show in our book is that rather than it being dispersed from a central location, that this was pretty much common knowledge that everybody knew. And while the stories might be slightly different, or the names of the gods or God changed, the overall story is the same because they were all looking at and studying the same thing. They didn't have city lights at night blocking their view of the stars. You know, so when you look up at the night sky, this is what you saw. And over time, you know, the people would track these movements of the stars, and they would pass it down generation after generation. But one thing that I haven't mentioned yet is something called the precession of the equinox, which plays a very important role in the history of religion. And the precession of the equinox is, most people don't know that not only do we have a solar year, which lasts 365 days, but beyond the solar year, we actually have something that's called the Great Year. And the Great Year is also known as the precession of the equinoxes. You can look it up in any astronomy book or in the dictionary or in encyclopedia or whatever.
So, now the precession, to a lot of people who kind of look at this stuff, the precession is basically like, 26,000 years? And that's basically what a lot of people consider to be our orbit through the galaxy.
Right. Well, what it is it's one complete wobble of the Earth as it passes. Well, I'm sorry. It's one complete backward rotation through the zodiac. It's the precession of the equinox. So, at March 20th or 21st, depending on the day of the spring equinox. That's the point that the sun rises on the horizon. And then what happens is under the precession, the sun every 72 years backs up 1 degree and rises in a different location as compared to the constellations and the day of the equinox. So what we have, and it's roughly 26,000 years, 25,800 years, but this precession of the equinoxes was divided into 12 segments, just like we have our monthly calendar and the monthly zodiac broken into 12 sections, or the 12 constellations that are used for the zodiac. But so also was the precession. And these divisions of 12 in the precession are known as ages or houses. So this is basically these ages lasting 2,150 years are further broken up into great days, which are each day lasts 72 years, which is the average life of a man. You look in the Bible, the Septuagint, written by 72 authors, and the number 72, I think, in Islam faith, you get 72 virgins, and I argue that that is directly related to this great day under the precession of the equinoxes. But the precession of the equinoxes is very important because, you know, a lot of people think, well, these dumb pagans, they worshipped animals and they were too stupid, they really didn't know what they were doing, and they were just ignorant people, and then, you know, the Jews and the Christians came along and saved everybody from their ignorance. And that's really very far from the truth. If we look at the bull worshipped in Egypt, what was his name? Not Anis. Anis is the fish man in Sumerian. But anyway, the Egyptian bull, and you can find this in a lot of Egyptian art with the sun disk between the bull's horns. This was actually in designation for the age of Taurus. And during the age of Taurus, people worshipped the bull with the sun on its heads because the sun at the equinox rose in the sign of Taurus. You go forward 2,150 years, and the ages are approximate. They're not exactly, the degrees of separation with the constellations are not perfect, separations. But going forward 2,150 years, we end up with the lamb and, the Jews blow the shofar in honor of the ram. And Moses, in many art depictions, has horns on his head. And this was very direct symbology of the age of Aries, the ram. And then from the age of Aries, the ram, we move another 2,150 years forward. And, mind you that this is the precession. The precession runs backward through the zodiac, not forward like our monthly progression of the zodiac signs. So following Aries comes the sign of Pisces. And for the last 2,000 years, we've lived under the age of Pisces. And the symbol of Pisces is the fish. The word Pisces is Latin for fish. Jesus was the fisher of men. He fed the masses with two fish. Was he feeding the masses two real fish, or was he feeding the masses the knowledge of the constellation of the age of Pisces? So Christianity has ruled for the last 2,000 years, and now we are at the end of this age of Pisces, and some argue that we're already in the next age, and then others argue that the new age doesn't start for another, 149 years or so, depending on who you speak to. But like I said, it's very difficult to judge exactly when the ages start. But right now we're entering into the age of Aquarius. So when we hear this is the dawning of the age of Aquarius, this is a literal thing under the great year. This isn't just, make-believe and fantasy. The ages really do exist. And this is, this was known, this time measurement was known as archaeoastronomy. It was how they measured time. And we know that, there are scholars. In fact, there's an excellent book called Hamlet's Mill that the authors of the track, the precession of the equinoxes back at least 1,000 years before Christ, and we think that the knowledge of the precession actually goes back much farther than that. Now, like I said, we're entering into the age of Aquarius.
Would then in your mind, because as I'm listening to this, in your mind, is this acquired knowledge or is this knowledge that was given initially to people here on this planet?
I personally think it was acquired knowledge, but you know, at the same time, you could argue given knowledge. I think different people will have varying opinions on who gave it to us, and I'll use this as a chance to sort of switch gears and go from archaeoastronomy into shamanism. There was a researcher who died in 2000 named Terence McKenna who actually argued that psychedelics or entheogens were actually the catalyst that caused human consciousness and the human advancement. And that may seem far-fetched to a lot of listeners, but what most people don't realize is that the active ingredient in psychedelic mushrooms, such as psilocybe mushrooms, is actually a congener of what is known as DMT or dimethyltryptamine, which is an active neurotransmitter in every one of our brains. And, in the late 90s, a doctor out of the University of New Mexico, Dr. Rick Strassman, did studies on this substance, DMT, and found that he was not only able to recreate religious experiences, but he was actually able accidentally to recreate things like the alien abduction experience and things like that under this most powerful psychedelic or entheogenic substance. So, Terence McKenna detailed his argument of this in a book called The Fruit of the Gods that was published, I think, in 95 or so, which is still easily found. And then if we look at other cultures, and I usually like to start off with Native Americans because that's what most people are familiar with. And I want to mention here that, you know, a lot of people think, well, you know, these cultures, these people that use these substances, you know, they were just hallucinating, they didn't know better, you know, all of these things. And this is, I feel, a very arrogant and ignorant position to argue, because what people are doing that hold this type of position are doing is they're saying that, you know, our culture is only correct, and the millions of cultures or thousands of cultures around the world and millions of people who have practiced shamanism for the last, it's estimated to be 50 to 100,000 years old, far older than any major religion we know of. All of these people were just ignorant fools, and yet, you know, today in modern culture there's a huge upsurge in the knowledge of shamanism, and we still have practicing shaman all over the world. Now, coming back to the Native Americans, they used substances like peyote, which everybody is very familiar with. They also used things like datura, Amanita muscaria mushrooms have been found to be used in various North American cultures. And, you know, stemming down to Mexico, they also used peyote. Gordon Wasson, going back to him in 1957, published the first account and original discovery of, actually he was led to it by Wheatlander and Alexander Solgen just prior to 1957, that there was a so-called mushroom cult in Mexico that still used these mushrooms religiously, and up to that point nobody believed that mushrooms were really used religiously. So he traveled down to Mexico and was the first white person allowed to partake in the mushroom ceremony with a Mazatec Indian woman named Maria Sabina, who is well recognized all over the world today as sort of a modern saint. And so, South America, they use a brew that's well known, and David Icke and a lot of these other researchers have recently discovered this information and gone down to the Amazon and done this substance ayahuasca with the shaman down there. And what's interesting about ayahuasca is, again, the active ingredient in it is this DMT substance, the same one that's found naturally in our brains. People that want to argue that these substances are something that's outside of us and they couldn't possibly create real religious experiences, Well, in actuality, these are substances that are found within us, and we also have to realize that without the plants, we wouldn't exist to be able to even question if plants had the ability or not to spark our consciousness.
Right.
So, you know, that's, I'll let you...
Well, you know, I know that here in Oklahoma, you know, the Native American population is quite high, that there are a number of people who are practicing shamans, and my wife knows of a couple that people go to regularly for medical information, and these people are spot on with their diagnosis. They don't have a stethoscope, they don't have an X-ray machine, they're not doctors, but these people just have the ability, either learned or through psychedelics or what, I don't know. But they have the ability to tell people what's wrong with them. So and when you have them going and getting these diagnoses confirmed with a medical doctor, it's hard to dismiss that type of stuff.
Yeah, and you know, that's very common in Peru and South America and other countries, that if a modern doctor is unable to diagnose, he will often send his patients to a shaman. And vice versa, if the shaman doesn't figure out the problem, you know, the shaman will send the patient to the modern doctor. You know, but shamanism has multiple folds in it, and a lot of people in our culture sort of focus on only the positive aspects, and sort of become a neo-shamanism sort of fluffiness to it. You know, there's a professor up in Wisconsin, Dr. Neil Whitehead, who's produced a number of books on dark shamanism and how it was used for warfare. And, you know, just as people knew the plants for spiritual and healing purposes, they also knew the poisons and things that could kill people.
Right.
You know, and that's a very real aspect as well. But, you know, it was used as a system of government. It wasn't just random use of poisons and things like that. And Dr. Neil Whitehead was the first researcher to really get into that. But one thing I wanted to sort of branch over to is the history of entheogenic or psychedelic research in Christianity.
Right.
And I mentioned earlier Gordon Wasson and, you know, before him Ramsbottom and Rolf and Rolf sort of touched on, I mentioned the plain Corot fresco in France earlier that were Adam and Eve on either side of the mushroom. And, you know, at the time there were not, it wasn't known that there were so many mushroom representations in Christian doctrine, you know, in Christian symbolism and things like that, you know, that we know of today. And then, you know, I'm still discovering more references all the time, like the Winchester Bible somebody sent me last week that had some great mushroom representations in it. There is a Psalter called the Canterbury Psalter that was discovered by an associate of ours several years ago that we have published in our book that clearly shows Adam and Eve on either side of mushrooms and shows Jesus as the Lord of magical plants and things like that, and we cover that in great detail in the book. But where the research into Christianity got serious was with one of the lead Dead Sea Scrolls scholars named John Marco Allegro. And John Allegro was a philologist that had studied at Manchester and earned his master's degree and then went to Oxford. And while at Oxford, he was called in. He was such a, you know, excellent philologist, which is a lover of words or lover of language. And he was called in to be the only representative for England to translate the Dead Sea Scrolls. And I believe he was the only philologist on the team. And John Allegro, he had originally started out as studying the Methodist ministry, and then he ran into so many problems with the stories that he decided to begin studying language, which led him to be, you know, one of the translators of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And the other members of the Dead Sea Scrolls team, put together by Father Joseph Millick, were all Catholic, except for him. And I think one of them, John Strugnell was Protestant or something like that. But for the most part, the entire team was Catholic. And like I said, John Allegro, as he continued studying, he could no longer hold his Christian faith, so he decided that he was agnostic before he got to the Dead Sea Scrolls, and he was really the only one that didn't have predetermined ideas on what they would find in the scrolls. And throughout his work on the scrolls, he was constantly at odds with the people from the École Biblique, which is the Vatican library arm, and also the formerly Badgett Lay argued that it was headed at the former Holy Inquisition office, that they shared the same office. I never verified if that was true. But he was constantly in a battle with these people over interpretations, and he was the only one that was non-Christian and wasn't assuming the stories from the get-go. And he began to look at things from different angles, and then when Wasson's book, Mushrooms, Russia, and History, and then his later book, Soma, the Divine Mushroom of Immortality, came to light, Allegro was reading those as well as these other two, Ramsbottom and Rolfe that I mentioned, and started looking at the chain of events, looking at the possibility that Christianity was based just as much on psychedelic drugs as Hinduism and Buddhism and, you know, the Native American religions and everything are as well. And so in 1968, he finished all of his work on the Dead Sea Scrolls, and he was actually the only one to ever finish his assigned duty. Most of the other scholars held their work back for more than 40 years, even though they criticized Allegro. He was the only one that published his work in a timely manner that was acceptable to the, you know, the scholarly profession.
Right.
And because he was the only one that would release his work, he was attacked and ridiculed constantly, and his work was marginalized. Even before he came out with his landmark book in 1970, which was called The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross. And so he was really the first researcher to take a serious look at Christianity and say, you know, look, you know, here's all the evidence, you know, and he tried connecting it into Sumerian, and we had to track down a Sumerian expert to, you know, everybody said, you know, there's not a single Sumerian expert in the world who would argue that John Allegro could be correct. Well, we found one. And, you know, so basically what we started doing was researching and trying to resubstantiate John Allegro's work on the entheogen side and sort of bridge the gap. You know, the camp of the astrotheology research had been around for years. And then in the 1950s came the entheogenic studies, or the shamanistic side of the studies. And, you know, we were sitting here looking at these two fields and trying to figure out how the two fit together. So that's what we started doing. And then we realized that we had to contact John Allegro's family, and we ended up working with his family for about 2 years. And tracking down some other experts that said, well, you know, we think that, you know, there is a possibility that John Allegro could have been right, you know, and obviously not all of his inferences were correct. He did have many errors because he was a pioneer, but I think 50 to 70% of his research at least is correct. And so what he did was show that that Jesus was not, you know, like we mentioned earlier, Jesus was the sun character. Well, this bright red and white Amanita muscaria mushroom looks like the sun growing on the ground. And we found this correlation, the macrocosm and the microcosm, in these ancient philosophies that where they believed as above, so below. So if the,
right,
you see the sun in the sky and it has clouds passing in front of it, there must be a sun on earth. So when they would be walking through the forests, and Jesus is the carpenter, he's always associated with the trees. These mushrooms grow in a symbiotic relationship with trees, especially conifer, pine, cedar, birch, things like that. And, you know, so John Allegro argued that Jesus was not only the sun, but also an anthropomorphism of the psychedelic mushrooms.
So how did this information basically get lost to us, Jan? You know, if some believe that the use of these psychedelics was the beginning of our conscience, it would stand to reason, if you use that range of logic, that for our evolution to continue, we would need to be continuing to use those same items.
Well, there are certainly many people that argue just that, and there are certainly many people out there, if you dig around in this area of research, who argue that people who haven't had the full-blown experience aren't up with the rest of the group. And in fact, a lot of these indigenous cultures that use entheogens, actually, you're not considered an adult in a lot of these societies until you've had your first full-blown psychedelic experience. But, you know, how that came about is either... It was probably twofold, you know, greedy shaman trying to keep the information for themselves, and, you know, slowly guilds and secret societies built up where they've sort of kept this information to themselves, but at the same time, maybe, you know, outside invading sources that didn't have the knowledge or had lost it with the desertification of the Sahara-Asian region, you know, lost knowledge and would chase after it and would persecute the people who used it. And it's also possible that a lot of the shaman just hid the knowledge to keep it safe.
Right.
You know, but it really comes down to one thing, which is greed and its suppression.
And so that brings us into the modern day church. I mean, if this information's been widely available, was widely available for... well, centuries, and we've had a number of similar savior-type stories all the way up to Jesus, and I'm assuming past then. And you've got a church who has become basically a governmental body of religion. It would seem like they would do whatever they could to absolutely suppress it and keep it away, because by opening that up, then you create freedom for everyone else.
Right, you know, and that's exactly what we argue that the Inquisitions were really about, and that's why our video is called the Pharmacratic Inquisition. That's the drug-ruling Inquisition. So, you know, and that, you know, that's exactly what we're arguing, which is continued all the way up to today, as John Ott, another famous researcher stated, you know, in the guise of the public health war on drugs. So, you know, basically, you know, we look back and all of the history of religion is surrounded in sun and star worship and drug use. And, you know, Middle Eastern religions, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam are no exception. The Bedouin were shaman. You know, I didn't even get a chance to go into Christmas. I'll mention that real quick, but... You know, I mentioned that these mushrooms only grow in a symbiotic relationship with certain types of trees,
right.
And the mythology of the evergreen with the brightly colored packages that we decorate and bring into our house that every Christmas time, that is twofold. The Christmas tree is one symbolic of the Axis Mundi of the world tree, the Yggdrasil tree. And it is also symbolic of what grows under the mushrooms. And as we know, every New Year's celebration, everybody likes to go out and get drunk or get inebriated. Well, this wasn't any different 2,000 years ago or more. And the people would go out and get inebriated, and it just so happened that the inebriation or the tool that they used to get inebriated grew underneath the tree. So we have... the story of you know, the Christmas tree and the mushroom, and actually in Siberia and northern Germany, etc., where these things were practiced, the shaman were reindeer herders, and reindeer, it's very well documented by numerous scientific sources that reindeer's favorite food is the Amanita muscaria mushroom. So we have the story of this man who dresses in red and white, the colors of the mushroom, who flies around in a sleigh by flying reindeer.
Ho, ho, ho.
And, the story of Santa Claus is really taken from Odin or Woden as, and he would fly on his chariot through the sky pulled by goats, and it's really the same story being repeated. He goes around the world and... a night, and the chariot is actually the Big Dipper going around the North Pole, and it goes around the North Pole in one night, but
right.
In Siberia, at the winter solstice, above the 66.5 degree latitude line, the sun actually disappears. So what you have is literally a nighttime that lasts for 3 days.
Interesting. And so, the old adage that there's nothing nothing new under the sun... I think is proven correct here.
Yes, you know, and it's funny that you said that because, you know, I was listening to a couple of minutes earlier today of your talk with Andy when you said that. And then 2 seconds later, I flipped open a book and I looked down and that sentence was right there.
Well, I mean, you know, it's not, you know, everybody thinks that they've got something newfangled, new and improved, and everything's been tried before. You know, in one form or fashion, or we're just coming around to it because, you know, we've kind of allowed ourselves to be held back. I mean, the history of Europe is replete with the, I guess for lack of a word, of de-evolution technologically and health-wise. You know, and then here we are today, you know, doing some of the same things when there are items out there. One that can either show us the way or two, make life different and easier for us without the same type of side effects. And we seem just totally unwilling to go in that direction because we believe there's another way. We continue to, there's something new that we're going to find.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's one thing that I very well recognized in the writing of our book is that, you know, the more research I did, the more I realized that we weren't really uncovering anything new. We were just putting together an old story that's existed for thousands and thousands of years. You know, we were just repackaging, you know, taking archaeoastronomy and entheogenic or shamanic studies and combining the two fields into one so that people could begin to understand how they work as a whole together. You know, and these two fields have been battling for years over who was more right, and we looked at both the stories and said, you know, they're both right. They go together.
Yeah, I think when it comes to our origins and answering all these questions once and for all, I think it's just it comes down to the fact we just haven't dug deep enough yet. That one day archaeologists will dig deep enough, and a lot of the mysteries of our origins, and even how all of this information, you know, was given to people initially or how they acquired it, all of that will come to light eventually. One day when we do in fact dig deep enough.
Yeah, I think so. You know, and I hope that our work definitely helps facilitate that end. You know, and get people to wake up and realize that all of these wars being fought over religion and money and everything, or you know, the economic wars using religion as a Trojan horse to get people to believe, you know, the lies that the powers that be need the masses to believe to enable to go to war. Like, you know, the Christians saying, oh, the Muslims are evil. The Muslims are saying the Christians are evil. If they all realized that they were worshiping sun and stars and the moon and all of this stuff, you know, suddenly everybody would wake up and realize that they were all worshiping the same thing, just using different names for the exact same stories. And then suddenly there's no reason to fight over religion anymore, belief, faith. You know, we can begin to understand fact instead of holding on to ancient faiths and beliefs that are from cultures 2,000 years old or more that don't pertain to us anymore. But understanding the astronomical and entheogenic associations to these things makes them all become perfectly clear, and all of these ancient stories suddenly unravel and are easily understood.
Your websites, real quick, Jan.
Websites. The book website is GnosticMedia.com, GnosticMedia.com. The video website is the PharmacraticInquisition.com. That's pharma, spelled like pharmacy, cratic, C-R-A-T-I-C. And then the other one that I have, once again, is HempForFuel.com. And then TheHemper.net is where we house the audio archives.
Jan, this has been a pleasure. I think there's another show somewhere here because I think we just barely scratched the surface. And I think
I think so, unfortunately.
Yeah, a whole 2 hours is what we need, and maybe we can plan another show because I certainly enjoyed it. Our guest tonight, Jan Ervin, here on TruthNet Radio's TNR Live. Tomorrow night looks like open lines, and we'll go through the news and talk to you. And then Friday night is going to be Barry Zwicker here on TNR Live. You guys have a great night. We'll see you tomorrow night.